How we deal with challenges directly relates to our success and even our happiness and contentment. You've probably heard the saying that hard choices lead to an easy life and easy choices lead to a hard life. And so the question is, when life tests us, do we rise to meet adversity face on, or do we panic and maybe give up and seek something easier to do? Well, we often talk about resilience here on The Growth Mindset, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Stephen Stein, who wrote the book on hardiness. It was a concept that was first researched in the military, but ended up branching across all areas of high performance. We're going to learn today about the qualities that unite people who are unstressable and the mindsets that they have cultured to help them succeed in so many different areas. And importantly, what lessons and training you can employ to become more unbreakable and hardy. Stephen Stein has also written several books on emotional intelligence, which certainly relates, and we had him on the show a month ago, which was one of our most popular episodes ever, so I'm sure you will love this one as well. Also joining me on the interviewing team is Emerson Montano, who happens to be an especially hard individual. He recently cycled the height of Everest twice in a row, over a non-stop cold and rainy 30 hours, and in the process gave himself so much nerve damage in his hands that he couldn't use his hands for 6 weeks. So besides being an aggressive geek, he also seems to know something about being hard. And with that, hello and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Webster-Harris, and stay tuned for an education on resilience, hardiness, and how to distinguish between the myths and the facts when it comes to willpower. Stephen, could you please explain what hardiness is and how the research first came about and what you found?
So that I wrote with my colleague, Paul Bartone, who was a senior psychologist in the U.S. Army. He was at West Point. And he had spent most of his career looking at this, what differentiated people who were succeeding in life versus those who weren't succeeding so well. But looking at it kind of as a mindset view as opposed to skills. And it was interesting how they started their work. It was at the University of Chicago. And they were involved in studying executives at a telecom industry to understand how they deal with stress. And in the middle of their research, there was a corporate takeover, and a significant number of the executives they were studying got let go. They were let go of their jobs. They were laid off. They were fired. And that was kind of a dramatic event in the middle of your research study. But they were still working with these individuals. And what they found was there was a dramatic difference in how people dealt with these situations. She was throwing bubbles. And what they found was that some people were devastated by losing their jobs. They were just completely lost it. And other people thought, wow, this is a great opportunity. I really was excited about maybe doing something, going to business myself, opening a bakery or something I've always wanted to do. This was an opportunity. So that was the beginning of this area called hardiness, that is what they labeled it, because they started looking at the mindset. It wasn't called mindset in those days, but what were these people thinking? How do they approach life? What differentiates these two groups of people? And Paul, my co-author, extended his research to, instead of executives, for more blue-collar jobs. He studied bus drivers because he used to work summers as a bus driver. Said, you know, they're under a lot of stress too. I wonder if they, the good bus drivers from the not-so-good bus drivers, can we differentiate them? And lo and behold, they did. It was the same three factors that we call the three C's that differentiated those that coped well. The first was what we call challenge. And that is when something bad happens or is a negative situation, instead of sort of being depressed and falling apart over it, people with score high on challenge see it as an opportunity. They say, wow, maybe there's a silver lining in this. Where can I go with this? What can I do? How can I change my life to look at this differently? The second one is control. And what that is that people who feel that there are things within their world they can control. I can't control the fact that I just got laid off my job. And if I spent all my time fighting with management and all those people to hire me back, I'm wasting my time. That's not a good idea. But if I control things like get my resume ready, start looking at other opportunities, the things that I do have control over, I'll be much better off. And the third C is commitment. And that has to do with having a purpose in life, something that I'm engaged in, that I really believe in. And the people who were successful were the ones who felt, you know, there's something that they really want to do in life, that they look forward to. I really enjoy baking. I really want to dedicate myself to baking, or even believing in a higher being, believing in God for some people, drives them, gives them the fortitude to go forward. So those three C's back in those days, and again, we're going back about 25 years, has led to hundreds of research studies over time. Now, Paul, having been involved in the military, published most of his research in scientific and military journals. So he was working at West Point, for example, looking at leadership, because that's, you know, that's known as one of the centers of great leadership. And they looked at a bunch of different variables, and this factor that I'm talking about, hardiness, was one of the best predictors of who succeeded in the military as a leadership. So Paul and I were friends, and I said, you know, Paul, we got to bring this out into the rest of the world. This is not just a military thing. This is good for the corporate world. It's good for people who work in any kind of area in the world. So that's why we decided to write the book, Hardiness. And a lot of the research has transcended, has gone beyond the military, looking at police officers, looking at first responders, looking at, I did work with musicians, doing work with athletes. We looked at some stuff over high-performing athletes, finding these three C's in various ways within these different groups, the mindset that these people have in approaching life being a significant aspect of their ability to both deal with stress and succeed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look at Taylor Swift taking on the issues with her like music licensing and then just re-releasing everything and becoming the biggest artist on the planet. Embraced some opportunity with self-control and commitment. Smashed it.
And in my book, we talk about other musicians such as Madonna and others, Lady Gaga, who went through some traumas in their life and were able to overcome those traumas and become incredibly successful in their music careers.
I've always found it fascinating seeing people in the same circumstances. Obviously, it's easiest to do that with people that have gone through something the same as me and then reacted really differently. And seeing, like, you see some people really grow and get stronger and some people shrink and get weaker and the same brushes and stuff. It's really fascinating. And it's just something going on in their brain that's reacting to it differently. And you're like, oh, it could be so much easier. But it does sound very much like stoicism.
Emotions play a role in this. I'm not saying don't feel sad or don't regret the fact that you've been fired or whatever. It's unfortunate, but then we got to sort of find ways to move beyond it. And those emotions that we experience often motivate us. That's the purpose of emotions, right? They often alert us as a warning signal or motivate us to do something different. So the anger that I have of being fired, I'm going to turn that anger around and use it to find my next pot of gold out there.
How about just positive thinking in general? Because a lot of these are just like a positive reaction to something versus a negative reaction.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of just positive thinking. That's kind of a denial. You're sort of saying, oh, everything's wonderful, you know, Pollyanna. It's not the way the world is. There are crappy things out there. And you got to accept this crap.
I would also say that, like, it's a positive framing of a challenge to be like, okay, this is an opportunity for me to get better or to learn from things, as opposed to it's a negative framing to be like, okay, I'm useless. I'm just going to quit and never do this again. Like,
exactly. That's what we call that reframing, not positivity.
Yeah. I'm very not into the, like, whatever the secret and like affirmations and just being like, cool, if I believe I can do it, everything will be easy. And you're like, no, you have to believe and you have to do it. You have to do all the hard parts. Like, just thinking it's going to happen, like, isn't going to make it so.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to accept what's out there, not deny it, and just say everything's wonderful and say, okay, well, what can I do about this? And then we reframe it in a more active way that we can go forward.
So you were talking about hardiness and how it relates to handling stress. And you gave some examples like the corporate takeover, which sounds like it would play out over weeks or months. But it sounds like this research was coming out of the army. People in the army might face periods of extremely acute stress that might be only a few minutes. Does hardiness play a big role in dealing with very short bouts of acute stress as well as long-term bouts of more chronic stress?
It can, definitely. Because, again, think of it as working out in the gym and building your muscle. So if you're strong in these skills, these three C's, then you can draw on them quickly or when you need them. You've practiced them, you've worked with them. In terms of the chronic, one of the areas that we've read about in the book, Hardiness, probably the worst situation you could imagine in the world is being a prisoner of war, right? And we document cases of prisoners of war and how they survive that extreme stress. And these three C's come up as kind of, again, a differentiator of those who seem to survive being a prisoner of war versus those who do crumble under the stress and not make it. So yeah, it's good for the short term and it's good for the long term.
How do you think you would respond to being a prisoner of war?
Not very well. I don't like pain.
Yeah. Good to know ourselves.
Right.
Yeah, it's not something I look forward to, but I've always been like, kind of like, I wonder what would happen.
That it depends on who you're captured by.
Yeah, also that.
Yeah, that might make a difference for sure.
Yeah. I was thrown in prison once for no reason and threatened with being raped. And I think I performed quite well during that period.
You're good on hardiness.
Yeah. So would you say that your hardiness, other than response to like major too much levels of stress, has also improved through your research?
I would think so. Again, it's a matter of being more aware of these skills, more conscious of them, that I think makes a difference. So when something happens, again, I think, well, how much control do I have over the situation? Is it really worth my while to rage anger at this person when that's not going to make a difference? Or am I going to kind of move in a different direction and try and do something positive? So yeah, it makes me much more confident in terms of commitment too. Like my purpose, things I want to do in terms of my work, spreading the word of our research, our work is a purpose for me, writing these books. Knowledge, education. So those things drive me to a great degree, different things that I'm involved in.
In terms of your writing practices, what are your writing habits?
I have a pretty hectic work life. I travel a lot and do a lot of different things. So let's say I schedule Thursday from 2 to 5 to do my writing. If I'm not in the mood or things aren't sitting well, that's not a good thing. So it's important to know how to get into the mood and how to make sure that those 2 hours are productive. So I use music. So I know one of the things that I used to get through my hardiness book was Van Morrison. I would turn on some Van Morrison music and I would start working. And if it wasn't working for me, I'd sort of change it up and I'd put on the band Chicago. And Chicago would give me a bit more energy and motivate me along the way. So I use music a lot in terms of motivating and getting myself moving myself forward in writing, because I can't afford to waste that time. If I've only got a block of time to write, it's got to be productive. And the only reason it's not productive is I'm not in the right frame of mind, right? I'm thinking about something else or other things happening. So I've got to focus on writing, and the music will guide my focus in the right mood and get me to write what I've got to write and get me through it. And I've written 5 books, so I have a pretty good success rate using that.
Because I would say certainly emotional intelligence and hardiness both have an element of control of your emotions to be able to put them to one side to do the important thing. That's
critical. I mean, that part of my learning working with high performance athletes was they have to do that all the time. And performers, that's their life, right? You've got a tennis match coming up at Wimbledon or somewhere. And if you're not in the mood, you can't say, I'm not in the mood. I don't feel like playing today. You've got to put yourself in that mood. So having worked with some of these athletes, we've learned some of these techniques such as visualization, music, in terms of getting them in the mood. Olympic athletes who use music it's not just any music. There's an art and science to which music you use for what kind of a competition or who you're competing against. Again, I've written about some of this, so it's really interesting how a master chess player will use a certain type of music against one type of opponent versus a different type of opponent, where he wants to be more aggressive in one situation than in another. U.S. Olympic swim team swimmers use particular music at a certain RPM rate per minute, depending on the kind of race and what they want to do. They want to go too fast because that'll tire them out. So they have to adapt to the right music at the right pace to the swimming they want to do in that particular race. So there's a whole art and science that we've used with athletes and with performers in terms of being in the right mood to perform that you have to perform. I've learned to do that when I have to do things like give a presentation or write a book or whatever. And that's emotional intelligence, knowing how to put yourself in the right frame of mind to get done what you have to get done.
Yeah, nice. I certainly find this really helpful in my own writing and have found it annoying that whenever you enter most like marathon races and things, they don't let you listen to music and you're like, but not fair.
Yeah. Then you got to do it in your head. And I've trained people in those situations. What are your favorite songs? What's your playlist? Right. And then just learn to do it in your head.
I knew someone who said when she was swimming, she would sing a song in her head, a different one every day.
Exactly. Yeah.
I am delighted to recommend my sponsor, Cozy Earth, whose bedding and loungewear I genuinely love. It's made from high quality viscose from bamboo, and it gets softer with every wash. It was voted as Oprah's favorite things several years in a row, and it's because their bed sheets are so damn incredible. Their collection also includes some divine loungewear for your home or travel. They have cute little tote bags to carry your gear anywhere, so whether you are exploring through a journey of personal growth or discovering new parts of the world, you can nestle up under starry skies with the softness of Cozy Earth's loungewear. So pack your bags, venture on and visit cozyearth.com today and use code GROWTH at checkout for an exclusive 35% off. And let Cozy Earth be your travel companion on the road to adventurous growth. cozyearth.com and use code GROWTH at checkout.
You talked about how emotional intelligence tends to grow over time. What about hardiness? Does that change as you age?
That's a really good question. We really haven't found that yet. We have found that same kind of change in hardiness, but I think there's sort of more research to do in that area, looking at whether it will change over time. It may be a little bit more resilient. You may be, you know, unless someone really intervenes and teaches you about control, or, you know, something changes your life and suddenly you're committed to something, you find your purpose in life. I don't think it changes as naturally.
Are there many clear contributing factors in childhood that change your hardiness? Like, imagine you're being a refugee. I would just expect that you'd be better at being flexible. And there's certainly some studies around like refugees make better businesses.
It's interesting. Some people, again, it increases their hardiness, right? Because they deal with the challenge. They have a purpose in life. They really want to succeed. They want to leave behind where they came from. So it really varies on the person, but there are examples of people who are refugees and strong in hardiness and succeed to a great deal. In our hardiness book, I think we have some examples of that, of people who came from very difficult situations, but were able to triggered around and be very successful.
It sounds like the military or police forces would be really interested in increasing someone's ability to deal with stress. Do they have success in trying to do that?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned the West Point example, where it's a big part of the training there for leadership. Hardiness is a component that's one of the places it was studied and implemented. But there are police forces and others, and again, examples I give in the book where they've implemented ways of trying to both assess for hardiness and train for that mindset, the hardiness mindset.
So it doesn't necessarily change as you get older, but with some focus and training, you can actually improve it.
Right. By becoming aware of it is the first step. Like, people have read our book and suddenly reframed how they see things in their life. And it gives them a handle on what they can do to make a change. And, you know, like on the control issue, you know, I've been wasting a lot of my life trying to change the world or change these things that I have no control over. Suddenly they start to refocus and look at, well, what do I have control over? What things can I change around me? And it makes a big difference for some people. So that awareness and building those skills.
Do you ever have people reach out to you for specific coaching, like for performance coaching and things, or is it more that you just work with big organizations? And
we have very few that I will take on. I mean, I do a lot in the entertainment world, the celebrity world, so much of my individual work is more focused in that area.
Cool. Guess you can't talk about clients. But of your books, Which book are you most proud of writing and why?
That's tough. It's like, which of your children do you like? It's hard to say. I mean, I really like the Hardiness book, really. I like what we did with that book. But my best selling book was my book called The EQ Edge, Emotional Intelligence and Your Success. And that was my first book. And it just keeps selling. It's an international bestseller. I don't know why. I don't understand the nature of that. My Hardiness book is newer, so really hasn't had a chance to really spread its wings. But The EQ Edge, maybe because it was one of the first books in the area of emotional intelligence, but it just seems to have a much bigger fan base out there.
Which book was the most challenging to write and why?
Oh, good questions. More challenging. I guess the first one, The EQ Edge, was probably challenging because I was transitioning from more academic writing into writing for the public, like writing a popular book. And that started out to be more of a challenge. I mean, I've been writing most of my life. I've written things like essays, articles, things like that. But what happened was I hired a magazine writer to work with us because she wrote for the masses like all the time. I thought, you know, magazine writers must be the best writers out there because they write for the masses. They know how to write at whatever it is, grade six level, and capture people's interest. And I think that helped us a lot. I learned a lot from her about being more engaging and writing at the level you need to write at to be have a popular book. So I guess that one was the most challenging and it really paid off.
In terms of the lessons that you learned then to make your writing more interesting, what were those biggest lessons that she gave you?
Well, one is don't just say something. You sort of work around it. You sort of tell a story around it. And the whole idea of storytelling. And the other part of it is to try and have an unexpected ending, a surprise ending. So people are engaged by surprise endings. You don't want to hear the obvious. So we would try and frame things in a way that there was an interesting story behind it. And the ending may not be what you expected it to be. And that's what makes for interesting reading.
Okay, I do have some audible questions I always end on, which just seems like a very convenient segue from you being like, end with something weird. And I'm like, yes, I have weird things to ask you. So my first weird thing is, what is your earliest memory that you can currently recall?
One of my earliest memories was as a young kid walking on the street of where I lived, and the hurricane at the time, Hurricane Hazel was the hurricane, came to Canada. And just sort of walking to my house when the hurricane was coming. So that's one of my earliest memories.
Oh. How old were you?
I must have been three or four.
Okay, cool. Were you with family? Like,
well, when I got home, I was. Somehow I was on the street playing or something. And
you were just walking? You weren't running or anything?
Huh. No, just walking. I mean, I was 3 years old. I did not know what was happening, really. Yeah. But I found out later it was Hurricane Hazel.
Yeah, yeah. But clearly, like, memorable. And yeah, it's just interesting the kind of the bigger moments that somehow stick in our memory when everything else gets wiped when we're super young. I just like finding out about people's things. Nice. And then what's one of the kindest things
I thought it was really kind when I got accepted into graduate school. And when we first got accepted, the dean met with us individually and I was just so excited to be there. And he was just so kind and welcoming to have us there. That's something that's kind of stuck with me.
Did you have an especially low grade or a reason why you shouldn't have been accepted?
Yeah, I guess my grades were okay. I originally started in science because my parents wanted me to be a dentist. And I was always unsure about that. So I took all sciences, but then I took the odd psychology course. And I would always get A's in my psychology courses, but I would get like C's in my science courses. So yeah, I was kind of surprised because my record didn't look great. Yes, I had all these psychology A's, but it wasn't until my last year that I took all psychology courses. So I had kind of a spotty record. So I guess that's another reason I was really grateful that someone saw something in me in this particular area that I could excel because I wasn't going to make it in the hard sciences.
Yeah, that's a nice lesson. Huh. Yeah, and not very actionable for me as a non-university dean to go out and use in the rest of my life. But just generally accepting people who maybe get the chance to perform is always a nice one. So thank you for that. Cool. Any weird questions from you, Emerson?
Weird questions.
Right.
When was the last time you got confused?
There's a lot of times I get confused. I guess I was confused over when I was taking my flight. I was just recently in New Orleans, and I was a bit confused over my flight, you know, what time and when the flight was. I was with my wife, and I probably would have missed the plane if she didn't straighten me out and say, no, the flight's in the morning, and I thought it was in the afternoon, and I don't know how I got confused about that.
And when was the last time you felt like real wonder that you were moved by something?
I was really moved at... The reason I was in New Orleans is that I was at a conference, and it was a conference of a school psychologist. And one of the products that we've developed, our organization's developed, is a new way of measuring gifted kids by not using language. It's all sort of a nonverbal approach to gifted. And the whole idea is that much of what's used, and I speak mostly of America, what's used to select gifted kids and in courses is heavily relied on verbal, on language skills. And a lot of kids who come from more deprived backgrounds don't have that, because if you come from a wealthy background, your parents talk to you in a certain way and give you books and read to you. So we're missing a lot of gifted kids who come from more difficult backgrounds. So we released this tool that has become enormously successful. And I think what brought me into wonder was one of the school psychologists came up to me and said, we've compared your assessment against the existing one that we've been using, and we picked up 8 kids that wouldn't have been picked up from your assessment, 8 kids that came from difficult backgrounds who scored high on your sort of nonverbal test measuring giftedness that didn't show up. And that sort of made me feel in wonder and really excited that we're able to make that kind of contribution to society.
Very cool. All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show and letting us ask lots of questions.
Of course. All right. Thank you for the opportunity and have a good show.
Cheers. You're very welcome, sir.
Have a nice rest of your day.
Thanks so much for Stephen Stein coming on the show. He was such a good talker and all-round nice dude. If you want more of Stephen, well, he has written 5 books. We, of course, spoke in this episode about his book, Hardiness, but he's also written the EQ Edge and Emotional Intelligence for Dummies, that are really worth reading on the subject of emotional intelligence and might pique your interest. If you enjoyed the episode, you will also love our other episode with him around mastering your emotional intelligence. If any topic in the episode made you think of a friend who should hear about the science of hardiness, well, share the love and send them the episode, as that is how we grow. If you want to share with the world just how hard you are, well, perhaps share the episode on Instagram or drop a comment or positive review on the show. And of course, any feedback that you have, do feel free to email me at growthmindsetpodcast@gmail.com. And remember that life is too short to be held back by your fears or your inability to knuckle down and just do something when you need to do it. So listen to more Van Morrison. Take it easy and be kind to yourself today and every day.
Born before the wind, also younger than the sun.
Hi, I'm Jessica Porter, and I'm a hypnotherapist, as well as a total relaxation nerd. If you're struggling to sleep at night, I'm here to help. Sleep Magic is my new podcast of relaxing hypnosis, created to help you doze off tonight. With my episodes every Wednesday, I'm going to make suggestions that help you relax really, really deeply. And hypnosis is not what you've seen on TV. There's no swinging pocket watch or clucking like a chicken. I promise. I'm just here to help you make friends with sleep again, so you can get the rest you deserve. So search Sleep Magic on your favorite podcast app, and I'll see you there.